So what was your origins with Robin Sherwood? I mean, I guess it goes back to the 80s when it was first on, right?
It is, yes, and I tried to grow my own mullet, but I didn't manage it. I was a proper fan when I was younger, as a teenager, and then as you do, when you get older, I don't really fade away from it, because obviously you remember there's certain series that you watched when you were young that you really remember, and that was one of those. And then in the early 2000s, there was an English convention, and the people that were running it knew me from doing comedy parodies of sort of folk TV shows, and they asked me to do a Robin Sherwood sort of evening comedy play, and so I wrote this squashed version of the entire series that sort of ran for an hour and a half. It just was very fast-paced, sort of Saturday Night Live type quick humour, you know, quick skits. And so because of doing that, I obviously then had to rewatch the entire series properly and make sure that I knew all the background, all the outtakes, everything, so that anything that I put into the script, a fan would get. So that re-triggered my love for it, because that's the weird thing about Robin Sherwood, really. I mean, you come to it now and it stands up. It's not a show that has particularly aged. I mean, people always make a joke about the 80s haircut, but they're not really that, you know, the 80s. And they really, I don't think anything's aged particularly badly with it. And it's sort of quite an adult show. So you come back to it later in life and it you get more from it than you got when you were younger. The big themes that Kip liked to put in. So that was nice to me. So I fell in love with it again, and then just basically took over Robin Sherwood in a megalomaniac type way. But it was nice. It was a weird thing that nobody seemed to be doing anything for the 30th anniversary, and I couldn't really understand. You know, I basically wanted to go and do a silly comedy play again, and there wasn't any event that was happening. So somebody said, "Well, why don't you do an event then?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I might." And then somebody said, "No, you couldn't do it. That would be impossible." And I don't really like people telling me that I couldn't do something. So I went, "Oh, okay, then let's give it a go." And so that was the weird thing. I sort of fell into being an event organizer, which is not something I ever really thought I would do, but because of that, obviously, the audio came about, and that was a weird sort of fortuitous thing.
And you got a hold of the original script from the late 80s that Richard Carpenter had written.
Were you aware of it during the rounds, or...?
I had heard about it over the years.
Oddly, I went back and revisited the comedy play I did, and the whole start of the play is a conversation between Paul Knight and Richard Carpenter pretending to be Hearn and a knight of the apocalypse, talking about the knight of the apocalypse as if it was a new production that was going to happen. So I must have been aware of the rumours and the stuff going around. I had to have written that into the script and try and make a joke of it. Oddly, from pretending to be the producer in a comedy play, I then suddenly became the producer of the Knights of the Apocalypse. But I'm not really. I was incredibly lucky because I ran the event. A fan came up who had kept hold of the script for many, many years, the original copy, with all Kip's writing on it, with circling the little things and writing and pencil on it, and just said, "Look, I know that you're in touch with Kip's estate, so would you be able to, safely give this back to them if they don't have a copy?" And they didn't have a copy, and then Harriet, who was Kip's daughter, was over the moon that, she could have it. And I, just before I passed on, I said, "Well, would it be okay if I read it in case it might work for the audio?" And because at that time we didn't really have, we were just going to write a generic script. Somebody was going to write a script, and we were going to hopefully do it that way. So Harriet obviously agreed, and so we were able to have an original, Richard Carpenter script, which was amazing. I mean, as I said before, it's not really a change. I mean, people are expecting a huge difference between the script and the novelization, which is one of the perks, follows the original TV script as if it had been broadcast on television. Whereas, obviously, if you read that and then you listen to the audio, you'll notice the changes, but there aren't that many. It's just, you know, making it palatable for an audio medium rather than stuff you can see. I mean, it's always difficult with audio because you don't want to sound clunky by you know, pointing at things and going, oh, what's that man doing? Oh, gosh, he's raising his bow, and now he's shooting his arrow at us. And that's always a bit... You have to be very careful of dialogue like that, and I think there was maybe a couple of moments that were like that, but I think we've hopefully got away with most of it without sounding too forced, which is you know, you have to be very careful with audio that it doesn't come across as stagey, I think. So I rambled off the point there. I apologise. I'm very good at waffling in any direction that I wish to go.
But no, I mean, it really does work that way as an audio, and it's surprising because I realized listening to it at various points that Richard Carpenter probably was a very visual writer, because I'd realized there'd be moments like, oh, if they had done this on the TV show, it would be just sort of a montage set to Clannad music.
That's entirely right. There's the whole section of them going to Huntingdon to go to the castle like you say, a purely visual thing. So you've seen clips of them, you know, in at daytime, at night time, you know, trudging their way through various things, but we couldn't do that, and we couldn't obviously have to find a different way of marking the passage of time. So that was by the sound effects, so, you know, the owls, you know, it was night time, or you knew it was dawn, or lunchtime, whatever, and with little snippets of dialogue and the sort of fake Clannad, I keep saying Clannad now because obviously that's what it was, but the fake Clannad music in the background. But that's the major change. This is the really visual stuff had to be worked out properly as an audio thing. But that was quite nice in itself because it gave the Merriers a bit more sort of their usual banter and their usual chemistry, because some of that was, because it's a very action packed script, some of that was not in the Kip's script, is it? He was looking at the broad sort of feature length, the big action sort of version, and so we were able to, because of having to write more because of the audio, we were able to put in those little sort of, you know, follow Kip's lead and ape Kip's writing really, and give the Merriers a bit of sort of banter and humour, which, you know, I think that's one of the great things about Robin's show, is there is, it is that sort of, it's not certainly not comedy, but it's got those comedy moments because of the relationships between the characters. So I was really pleased that, you know, bits that I wrote for the montage seemed to really work because of how they were performed and the Merriers enjoyed doing them. So that's quite nice. And really, you're taking a cue from Kip, because having immersed yourself in his writing, you can sort of... I don't know what the word is really, but I suppose ape is the right word, or sort of follow his lead and make sure that you don't write something terrible.
Yeah. No, I mean, I actually wondered, I mean, I kind of figured it probably was added just logically because I know how they would do it on TV.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty... I was wondering how much of Nazir's dialogue had to be added, because on the show, so much of it was Mark Ryan's physical performance.
Yeah, that was true. And weirdly, although I think there's been a lot of people online saying, gosh, you know, there'll be nothing for Mark to do, or you know, you'll have to add in a load of stuff that isn't natural. In the original script, he has got quite a lot of lines, so... it's a weird, I don't know whether Kip suddenly thought, well, this is the last sort of thing, and that's a code, it might be nice to give Mark more lines to do. But there was quite a chunk, so we didn't realise that we added a huge amount, but it was just, we had to sort of give him a bit more just to make sure, because you can allude recording studio in the corner, just sort of brooding menacingly and not really saying anything. So so how did the gig join itself? Because it was trying to not put his natural Yorkshire inflections into the Saracen dialect. So, but yeah, he was brilliant because for him it was great to be able to, I suppose, just develop the character a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone said that there are more lines for Nazir in this than the whole of the series.
it's probably true, because this is a nice, chunky 2-hour script, so Cherno equally, he had to have a certain amount of lines. So he probably does, to be honest. And, I think it's quite nice to hear him speak. I think I mentioned to somebody that... you know, by the amount of time that he spent in Sherwood Forest, he's bound to have picked up English, you know, and he could. It was a sort of limitation of the series that he wasn't sort of developed beyond that. By the time Jason Connery was Robin, they'd been together a long time, and I think he would have been speaking better English, and he would have been sort of talking more rather than just sort of standing back and not doing that. So I think it's a nice sort of natural progression.
And, I mean, certainly by the third series, I mean, episodes like Sheriff of Nottingham, Nazir was talking a lot more.
Yeah, I suppose it is a natural sort of character arc, isn't it? I mean, you can do the brooding, the Clint Eastwood-style thing for so long, and then you need some... it becomes a... You don't want it to become a one-dimensional character, and that was, I think, the great thing was that... That was a great thing with all the characters, really, that they had backstories and... You know, they had relationships, and so there wasn't just, oh, here they are again, and they sort of, well, 1950s Robin Hood, hurrah, slapping our thighs. It was the proper, they went through stuff, and I always liked the fact that Little John always nearly got married to Meg, but never quite made it, so it was nice to keep him, a love interest. That's the nice thing. I think they've brought so many different things into the legend.
And one of the things I liked with it is that it pushed the storyline for at least two characters, trying to do it without spoilers, forward from the encounters in the show.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that we tried to... because it is a continuation rather than the standalone... I mean, it is, in a sense, a standalone episode, but we tried to... push through, things that, and even just throw away things. I know, obviously, people were expecting a big sort of getting Maid Marian out of the nunnery and all that sort of thing. How did she do that, or why did she come out? But there wasn't, in the actual script, there was nothing about that, so we just added like a couple of lines just to make it clear that, she had left and she was missing Robin and the Merry Men, and that's why she went. So.
Yeah,
it's like a tiny thing, and I'm sure people who aren't humongous fans won't spoil their enjoyment. But it's nice to sort of put that in for the dedicated fans to go, well, like if a dead maid marriage shouldn't be with them.
I had wondered if those lines were added when I was listening to it.
Yeah, they weren't in the. I think Kim just wrote